Today is March 1st, 2013. We are here with Dania. I want to call you, it's Alder.
Right.
For some reason, my third grade teacher was Mr. Adler.
That is the most common mistake people make with my name. They often just transpose the two letters, or even if I've just said it, they'll say Adler.
Mm-hmm.
So, no.
No.
The tree, not the snake.
Yep, that's what I was, I think that's how I had it in my mind to remember it.
Mm-hmm.
And my name is Troy Reeves. I'm with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. We're doing this here at the Academic Staff Institute. They've been kind enough to let us have a room and interview some academic staff during this day-long institute. And it's Dania, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
There's a tilde over the N that gives it that Enya sound.
Okay. So first off, and I might end up working a little bit back in time, but first off, let's talk about how you ended up getting a job here at UW-Madison.
Okay. My last job in state government, I worked in state government from 1985 to 1998, and my last job there was being the administrator of a tiny state agency called the Adolescent Pregnancy Prevention and Services Board. We funded comprehensive teen pregnancy prevention projects throughout the state, so that gave me experience in the world of prevention. I think they were The UHS was mostly interested in me for this job, though, because of my community organizing experience, and I have been doing that since I was born, it feels like, some time. Mm-hmm. I've just always been an activist of some sort or another, and when something bothers me, the best thing I can do is try to change it, and working with to get other people interested in that, and that kind of thing has been how I've gone about that. The position I was hired for was a sort of new position. They had tried to do, University Health Services believed at that time, and still to some extent does believe, that issues that are critical to student health, such as violence prevention, community engagement, civic engagement, community building, things like that, are as important as whether you caught the flu or not last month. And so, and that the director of UHS in 1998 was a real visionary by the name of Rich Keeling. And his belief was, we can go out and educate students, incoming students every year on how to take care of themselves, how to avoid violent situations, all that. Or we can look at the bigger picture issues and try to change things in a more systemic, lasting way than just going out and talking to 6,000 incoming students every year. And I was very intrigued by that as a possibility. So I got to hire everybody who came to work on the team. And they are, I'm convinced, still the smartest, coolest people on campus. They there were four people on the team most of the time. And they just know a lot. They are engaged with students. They know how to work with students, which is, I think, something you can't really teach, although to some extent you can. But anyway, four positions, community building, civic engagement, violence prevention, and I can't remember the four, volunteerism, sort of, community service. Mm-hmm. And there, the idea was they were not supposed to go out and just find more students to volunteer. They were supposed to look at ways to improve the volunteer experience that students have. So rather, they were not a mortgage center light. They were people who would find out what the community needs and then try to provide that, or encourage students to not just run out and say, I want to volunteer, but encourage students to look at the community and find out what the community needs and then offer what services they had in that regard. So it was a really great group of people. One of the most exciting things they did in the first couple of years was something called Freedom Ride 2001. And it was a history class about the African-American civil rights movement. There were three faculty involved in it, but really the people who worked at UHS at that time did all the hard work of arranging that. It was a bus trip through the Deep South. They started out here and went, the first stop was actually in Chicago, where they talked with Diane Nash. They ended up, driving through Alabama and Mississippi. The staff on that trip began a relationship at that time with the an organization in Selma called the National Voting Rights Institute, and a woman named Joanne Bland was the director of that. And so subsequent to this trip, which was, it took 3 weeks They stayed all over the South. They went to a variety of places. Probably the hardest time they had was they went to a former plantation, and where they tried to engage the people in the hoop skirts in talking about slavery. The people in the hoop skirts were hired by the Department of Tourism not to talk about things like that. So it was a real clash of of purposes. But one of the best things that came out of that was the work with Joanne Bland, who was director of the Voting Rights Institute. The UHS staff subsequently took several service trips to the Institute and helped them clean up and put up drywall and paint. But they also, I think it was on their third trip there, started working on oral histories with people in the surrounding area who had been part of the civil rights movement, but who were also dying off as the time had passed. This was already 50 years beyond, 40, 50 years beyond the civil rights movement. So it just, it made for a very rich relationship. So after a few trips down there, they also brought Ms. Bland up to the UW-Madison, and she was part of a panel to talk about the civil rights movement. One of the things that was fascinating to me about that whole experience was that one young woman who was ready to leave this place, just had had it with Madison and the UW, decided to stay on and finish her PhD in history here. And she said she had, she's an African-American young woman, I believe she was from Milwaukee, but she said that she learned more about herself on that trip and what she was capable of, as well as learning about history. She had just not known much about the civil rights movement and until that trip, she said. What she knew came from books and not was not experiential learning. So things like that. A young white man was on the trip who said he had never felt like he belonged here, but after that trip he did. And frankly, we thought white males, if anybody feels like they belong here, that would be the group. So things like that came out of it. It also engendered a lot of good press for the university. There was a woman on the trip who was taking history classes, but also worked at the Capital Times as a reporter. Anita Weir was her name. So she took the trip and filed stories every day or two about what they were experiencing. And that's a very rich set of clippings that the university was able to take advantage of. So that happened. And then that was one of the biggest collaborative projects that the folks on my team did. So this takes us to 2001.
Would you mind, I think one of the most important things you can do is hire well.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like you did. I wonder if you wouldn't mind naming the four people.
Absolutely, Catherine Loving did the civic engagement work. We called it community organizing at the time, but really the preferred term is civic engagement. Stephanie King did community service work. A woman named Danielle McGuire, who's gone on to great fame, actually, in the civil rights arena, was doing the, what did we call it? I forget what, community building. Community building was what her work was called. And then violence prevention, first person hired into that was Lori Henn, who was in that job about 5 years. She left and we hired Carmen Hotvet to take her place. Danielle also left to go on to get a PhD at Rutgers and has since written a book that actually moves the start of the civil rights movement back about 10 years from the Rosa Parks incident in Birmingham and back to a sexual assault of an African-American woman and by white men. And Danielle makes a very good case that that's really when the civil rights movement in this country began. So that was Danielle McGuire. She was replaced by Rodney Horikawa, who teaches a class called Student SEED, and SEED stands for Seeking Educational Equity and Diversity. And that's, I think, one of the best classes the university offers, probably, at least things I hear from students. It was. So those, the original four were Catherine, Lori, Stephanie, and Danielle, and then Danielle was replaced by Rodney, and Lori was replaced by Carmen. So.
And this team is still extant?
Mm-hmm.
And you just retired.
Right.
Mid-January, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I just retired.
Yeah, just.
and congratulations.
Thank you.
So that takes us to 2001, but I actually want to back up a little bit because this does seem to fit what I know about you and what I've read about you, the idea of this overarching interest in social justice or activism. Mm-hmm. And you said that it started from, you know, you don't even remember it, sort of not
right.
starting. But I... I'm wondering how much it has to do with the fact that you've been out as a lesbian for, well, I think it's since 74, so
yeah.
You know, almost 40 years now.
Mm-hmm.
How much of your activism, social justice, comes from, you know, who you are?
You know, when I was in fifth or sixth grade, I think it was sixth, one day the teacher said we were not going to be going outside for recess that day because it was too cold. And I said, well, that's not fair. We're supposed to get a recess every day, and it's not too cold out there. And she looked at me and said, if you want to have a recess outside, go right ahead, and sent me out to the playground all by myself. Well, I was only out there about 5 minutes before other kids started coming out, because apparently they said, well, that's not fair that she gets to go and we don't. So I really jokingly trace my civic engagement back to that incident and how good it felt when I saw other students or other kids coming to join me. And I'm not exactly sure where that comes from. Some of it did come from my family. My grandfather on my mother's side was one of the negotiators in the 1939 steel strike on the side of labor. Mm-hmm. And my dad was involved. He started a labor union where he worked. If nothing else, I got the idea from them that if something bothers you, there's always something you can do about it. You know, you can take it to the streets if nothing else, but you can do something. Don't just sit there and feel bad about it. And so I really appreciate my parents giving me that. And which came first, the lesbian or the activism? Mm-hmm. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I do remember, as many women do, reading The Feminine Mystique when I was in my early 20s. And it was one of those books where I just went, oh my God, how did she learn so much about my life? You know, mm-hmm. because that was what it felt like reading that book. And that vague sense of, this is just not right, when I would be in a meeting as the only woman. And everybody else there was men. We're not getting the voices of everybody involved, so it can't be as good a decision as it could be if we did have. I was tolerated for a while in some of the organizations I went. I say now that the jobs I had first out of college are way too conservative for me now. I could not work at those same jobs. It would bother me too much, representing management all the time and that kind of thing. So luckily things worked out that I did get into more progressive places to work as time went by, or I found them, so.
Right.
And say again what your actual question was. I'm not sure
well,
if
I'll... I think you've got at it. Maybe what I'm interested in, since, you know, we not only do interviews with academic staff, but we do interviews with gays and lesbians, bisexuals, transgenders here on campus and in the community. So maybe my follow-up question really is, what sort of, if anything, were you involved in terms of the lesbian community, in terms of activism or raising awareness of gay rights in the 70s and 80s, maybe the 90s, before you got this job here?
Sure. I came out in 1974 in Louisville, Kentucky. And that process had actually started prior to that. When I was a senior in high school, my best friend's mom accused me of being a lesbian and seducing her daughter. And I didn't even know what that meant, so I went to the library to see what was a lesbian. And I always say the good news is, I read that all the available literature was that lesbians are sick, perverted, and disgusting, and nobody should be one. And then the other thing was all lesbians are either butch or femme, and butches act like this and do this, and femmes act like this and do this. This was what was available in the Warren, Ohio Public Library at that time.
Mm-hmm.
The good news is I was mentally healthy enough to not believe that I was sick, perverted, or disgusting. The bad news is I thought that meant I wasn't a lesbian. Because if I were, you know. And yes, it was a little bit bass-ackwards, but I spent the next 10 years sort of continuing to try to be straight, and then just finally said, you know, this isn't working. So I had moved to Louisville in February of 1974. A few months later, I started going to NOW meetings of the National Organization for Women. And in the NOW newsletter one time, there was a letter from this woman who said she believed that as lesbians, we were doubly oppressed by being women and being lesbians, and she wanted to start a lesbian rights task force. So I went to the group's first meeting, and for the first time ever, I said I was gay. I didn't like the word lesbian back then. It sounded too clinical to me, something a psychiatrist would use, not a real human being. And so I said I was gay. And, you know, within a couple of weeks, I was a dyke. You know? Reclaimed the word. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that was when it first, my sort of the bringing together of all these different aspects of my life came to be. And we did all sorts of things. We challenged the state law against sodomy. We challenged the state law that would not let a woman marry another woman. A couple of women went and filed for a marriage license, and then when they didn't get it, they sued. We started, now in Louisville went through the thing that a lot of now, or local chapters have now went through, in that a lot of the straight women were very challenged by having so many lesbians in the room, and they kept saying the lesbians are taking over, and you know, we were like 5%, 10% of the group, but I think our energy was such that it felt like we were taking over. So they made us not feel very welcome there, so we left, and we formed a group called the Lesbian Feminist Union. And then that group did all sorts of things, educational. We rented a house in downtown Louisville where we could do classes and do consciousness raising, and we'd have yard sales to generate money to pay for what we wanted to do. That sort of went on for another few years. Then we decided to open a bar. Then a bunch of us set up a land collective because we all wanted to move back to the land. And not one person out of that group ended up living on the land for any amount of time. So that was sort of my life from like 1974 to at least 1980, 84, somewhere in there. I moved up to Madison in 1984, in part because a friend of mine had moved up here a couple years before I did. And we'd be talking on the phone, and she'd say, "Dania, it's legal to be queer here." I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "They passed a law saying you can't discriminate against lesbians and gay men in housing, employment, and public accommodations." And I thought, that is really interesting. I wonder what it would be like to live in a place like that. So I came up and visited a few times, and my friends were very strategic. They took me to places where I would see lots of other lesbians and stuff and be wowed. I mean, in Louisville, bless its heart, there were maybe 25 lesbian feminists who all kind of hung out together. And when one couple would break up, there'd be this ripple effect throughout all the other couple. "Well, I always wanted to go out with her," you know. So we jokingly called it incestuous, but with no intent of diminishing the experience of incest. But
right.
It felt like that at times,
right.
You know. It felt like we were all spinning around. So I moved here in December 26th, 1984. Moved to Madison, and I've lived here ever since then. I think about moving back to Louisville now. They've made some amazing progress. There's some very brave activists there who have worked and gotten legal protections for gay men and lesbians in Louisville, in Jefferson County, which is the surrounding county. There was a story that was all over the news a few weeks ago that the smallest town that anybody knows of passed a law protecting lesbians and gay men in employment and public accommodations. And the town is Vico, V-I-C-C-O, Kentucky. And it was great. They've taken an approach of, they called their efforts the Fairness Campaign. And they've been very smart about working with other groups trying to get and improve their civil rights. And so it's a very coalition-based kind of group. If there is a rally going on for African American rights, they will be there. If there's a rally going on for somebody's religious rights, they will be there. They just make it a point to be involved with every other rights-seeking group.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been great to observe it, even from a distance.
Right. Daniel, I want to make sure we get a couple more things here.
Sure.
First, I want to give you space to talk more about your work for
mm-hmm.
UHS. What other sort of major? It doesn't have to be major. What sort of things, you know, stand out in your mind? Sort of that post 2001 after the.
Sure. One of the things that I loved the most was one of our RNs at UHS said we need a brochure on lesbian health. And I took that very seriously and ran with it and got to write one of the most fun projects I've ever... I am basically a writer. I majored in journalism and public relations in school. And but if there's any sort of generic thing that I've done all my life, it's been writing. And I wrote this amazing 35-page booklet on lesbian health issues that I got more praise for than I think anything I've ever done in my work life. One of our doctors at UHS said it was, in his 25 years of practicing medicine, it was the best patient education piece he'd ever seen. And I mean, I was like, well, I thought it was good, but I didn't think it was that good. Mm-hmm. So that was really exciting. And that also led to lots of collaborative kind of work where I sent it out, asked other people to review it and comment on it before we published it. I put a lot of humor in it. And one of the things people think is that lesbians and or feminists have no sense of humor. So I was just determined to fill this thing up with... there's a guy, actually, and I can't remember, Rex Wachner is his name, and he used to send out an email every week or so with lots of different quotes from people about LGBT issues. And I had been getting that for years, and the person who was doing the graphic design said, send me anything you can think of that we would fill the margins with. And so on literally every page, there's some kind of a joke or other. And they're not all jokes, but many of them are. There's one statement of, people think we hate men. We don't hate men. We just don't want to see them naked. So things like that that ease people's idea. And I think that was really effective. One of the people who worked at UHS at that time was, he's a very smart guy, but he wasn't really current on lots of things. And so when somebody was talking about going to a room of one's own to pick up some posters or something, he said, are you sure that's safe to go in? You're a man. And the guy looked at him and said, yeah. And he said, well, yeah, but they might hurt you. I mean, he literally thought he might get physically hurt. And so that was part of what was behind the humor, was to, A, to humanize us, and B, to get people just laughing about this and not take it all so seriously. So that was probably my favorite project I've ever done in 40-some years of working. I was also chair of the Equity and Diversity Committee at UHS for a long time, and we did a lot of things, panel discussions, book clubs, things that tried to, UHS, the people who work there, most of the jobs are very appointment driven, and so they know, they get an hour for lunch and they get no more than that, and so, or 40 minutes for lunch many days, and so you had to try to fit any educational efforts into whatever time was available, and that just worked out real well for doing like lunchtime book discussions or brown bag discussions and bringing people in. Gabe Javier, who's the not so new anymore, probably 2 or 3 years he's been here, director of the LGBT Campus Center, came over and brought panels of students to do education on trans issues, for instance. And very fortunately, the associate director of UHS's medical clinic is an MD who has a trans child, and she has helped raise the consciousness of people there on trans issues just by leaps and bounds, and in fact was behind some of the educational efforts that we did. And I think it made it seem not so, if you'll pardon the expression, weird that somebody people know has a child who is dealing with trans issues. I think that's an area among all LGBT issues probably has the most mystery about it, and Becky really contributed to raising people's consciousness and educating them. Those are the highlights, I'd say.
I want to make sure we get, since this is the Academic Staff Institute, I want to make sure to give you space to talk about the, you are a member of the Academic Staff Executive Committee for 6 years.
Sure.
So I want to talk about, I'll first ask, you know, why was that the process to become involved in that? So
sure.
Let's start with that.
One of the things I love about the university is the way that the very highest administration supports involvement in shared governance. I have been told, and I don't know from experience, but I would believe that the UW-Madison has probably one of the strongest, if not the strongest, shared governance system in the country. That there's no place else like it where the chancellor is expected to not only consult with, but to listen to people in the faculty shared governance area, in the academic staff shared governance, in classified staff shared governance, and student shared governance. And I have seen different chancellors succeed or fail based on how well they were attuned to that. I think one of Betty Martin's biggest challenges was she never did quite get what shared governance meant here, in terms of the level of involvement that people expected to have. And I just think that it's sad in a way, because I think she had so much to offer. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. One of the things about working with a team of people who are the smartest, coolest people on campus is after a while, they don't need you very much as a supervisor. They don't need you to say, have you thought about doing this? Because they've thought about it. They know their stuff. And so as my role was diminishing as a team manager and a group leader of them, I mean, frankly, the first 5 or so years I was in the job was getting that team up and running and helping them connect with people across campus and that kind of thing. Once that was done, and once I got to write that wonderful booklet on lesbian health, I'm not a health person. I'm not an RN or an MD, and so I don't have the kind of background that a lot of people might need to do that kind of work. I also don't have degrees in public health or anything. So I started noticing this thing. Well, actually, Kathy Poy, who was the director of UHS at the time, came over to my office and said, would you like to be an academic staff assembly representative? And I said, sure, what does that mean? but it sounded interesting, and it sounded like a way to be involved in the life of the campus in a different way. So I jumped at the chance, and for several years was just an assembly rep. Then I was elected to the Professional Development and Recognition Committee, which hands out academic staff professional development grants and also chooses the winners of the Excellence Awards. And then from that, went on to the Academic Staff Executive Committee and then became the vice chair of that group for the last couple of years I was involved in it. One thing Donna Silver said I should mention, we were talking about this the other day, Donna's the retiring secretary of the academic staff. Until I was on the PDRC, when the Excellence Awards event came up, there was nothing tangible that came from it. There was no program that said, these are the people getting these awards and this is why they're getting these awards, this is what they've done. And because I was at UHS and UHS had a really good communications team at that time, I said, what would you think about putting together a printed program for this event? Would you be interested in that? And they were very interested in it and had some extra money in their budget. So they actually even paid for the production of this program. And it was a really nice thing because we get 10 Excellence Award winners, and the idea that they would go home from that event with nothing in their hands except a check for $5,000, which is a big deal. But so we started doing that, and now the academic staff secretary's office has picked it up, and they do it. It's just as a matter of course. But prior to that, there'd been just nothing. So I felt like that was an important contribution that we made.
So in terms of academic staff executive committee, what does that, being a member of that, what does that mean for you personally, but also for academic staff on campus? What is the executive committee charged to do?
Well, they are the academic staff shared governance body, and they are the sort of working group of the assembly. The assembly only meets once a month. ASEC meets every week, except in weeks when the assembly meets, and so they meet three weeks out of the month, ASEC meets. And, what it meant for me was I started to get a much better sense of how this place works and how things function. And one of the staff on the original team that I put together said something one day about, she said, this place is so strange about money. She said, when there's something somebody wants to do, they always can find the money for it. But if nobody wants to do it, it sort of goes off and dies a very lonely death. And I just kind of remembered that. And so on ASEC, I come to learn that the chancellor has, I think it was about $5 million discretionary fund every year to do things with. The provost has a fund like that, a slush fund, I'll call it for lack of a better term. But so learning that that's how that happens. These people do find money because they've got these huge pockets of it that WARF or somebody gave them, or the Alumni Association. One of the coolest parts, though, of being on ASEC was hearing ideas come back that I had sort of tossed out there. For instance, one of the things that bothers me about a very standard way of doing business, when it's time to give out raises, They are based on a percentage of your existing salary. Well, what that does is perpetuate the lowest paid people stay the lowest paid and the highest paid people stay the highest paid because they're getting a 2% raise. Well, 2% of $20,000 a year is a heck of a lot less than 2% of $400,000 a year. And so I started saying, wouldn't it be better if we had, okay, give the percentage raises because there's no simple way to replace that, but how about if we have a floor and a ceiling so that nobody gets less than a $500 a year raise, just pick a number, and nobody gets more than a $5,000 a year raise, that there's this range. And I said that at a meeting, and then a couple meetings later, somebody said, you know, we should have a floor and a ceiling for these percentage raises that we're doing. And I'm like, wow, this is cool. So it gave me the opportunity to put some ideas out there and have other people latch onto them, and if they thought they were good, and run with it. And that was a really cool feeling. Mm-hmm. I think it's a very similar feeling to what one gets if one is the president of a corporation or something, where you can just say, this is how we're going to do things. But very different in that it's collaborative, and I was not saying this is how we're going to do it. It's just mm-hmm. offering ideas. But I got to be involved in things like the HR design, things like search and screen committees that hiring the future leaders of the university, and just things that I would not in my work at UHS have had the opportunity to do. So I really appreciated the opportunity and appreciated the support that from the chancellor's office on down, the support there is for involvement in shared governance here.
Mm-hmm. One more thing I probably should have asked this earlier, but mm-hmm. I'm always interested in space and place on campus, and University Health Service moved.
Yes.
Its space during your 14-ish years there.
Mm-hmm.
What, if anything, would you like to comment on about the move from basically near here mm-hmm. to the University Square or the Lucky Building, whatever you want to call it.
333 East Campus Mall.
333 East Campus Mall.
You know, when I first went to work in that rundown little building down there, one of the cool things was Kathy Poy, who was the director of UHS, executive director for, I think, 5 or so years before she retired. She'd been the associate director when I went to work there. She was an assistant director before that, and she was an RN working on with students before that. She actually... That building used to be something that an organization that it housed an organization that worked with severely retarded, and I don't know what the appropriate term is, but severely disabled children. Mm-hmm. And Kathy remembered going through there as a rotation when she was in nursing school here. And then she came to work there. I mean, she worked one other place. I think she worked as a public health nurse for a year maybe, but then went to work at UHS and was there for the rest of her working life. And just that kind of history was interesting to have. Now, all the drinking fountains were this low off the floor because they had to be so kids could reach them and stuff. All of the folks on my team had private offices at that time in that building. When we moved to 333 East Campus Mall, somebody thought it'd be a good idea to put them in cubicles. And I don't think I ever got over that. It was so... People actually came through when we first moved into that building, and people from other parts of UHS, and said things like, gosh, I thought they respected you all a lot more than this. So some with the insensitivity of others and stuff, it just drove home that these are really hardworking professionals, and to be put into cubicles was just, I felt like it was insulting. And I don't know when that decision got made and who made it. But it was distressing to me that they weren't respected any more than that. There wasn't anything I could do about it, apparently. We looked into expanding the cubicle walls to go to the ceiling, but everybody we talked to said, that's horrible. It cuts out all your light. The air gets messed up, so don't do it. So we didn't do that. But so we moved to a much more central location, which is great for students. I used to worry about students with a sprained ankle trying to make it, especially if they lived in Celery or something. And what a hardship that was on them. It was, so we were there from 98 until, I don't know when East Campus Mall opened.
2008?
It could be.
I mean, I got here in 2007, and they were finishing it.
Okay.
But I don't think they were in it yet.
That sounds about right. It's a great building. It's a great location. I won't say it's a great building. It's a great location. It's one of the ironies, though, is UHS was split up into at least two locations prior to that. We had the building at the fork in the road, but then the folks in counseling, when I first came to work there, were at 905 University Avenue, and then moved to, there's a res hall, or a former res hall over here, to something North Orchard.
Okay.
I forget what the name of it was, but anyway, the counseling staff went there when 905 was closed. It was closed down and then leveled to make room for the business school. And so we were in these different locations, and the mantra that was said over and over again before we moved to 333 East Campus Mall was, won't it be great when we're all in the same facility and we can collaborate and we can find each other more quickly? And we talked to each other much less when we moved down to that building, in part because of the natural separation that occurs when you put people on different floors of something, and they don't have to walk up and down the stairs to find each other. They, you know, you're on the eighth floor. The UHS is floors 5 through 8. So if you're on the eighth floor, you're not gonna necessarily run into people as you're walking up the stairs in the morning, as opposed to being in a three-story building where you do. So it just struck me as so ironic that we all thought we were gonna work together more and better, and I think it was exactly the opposite happened. So there was that, but the central location just can't be beaten. And now it's part of the whole East Campus Mall thing, which I understand was the brainchild of Lamar Billups, who's a dear friend of mine who used to work with the chancellor, a special assistant to the chancellor. And Lamar died last November. But at his memorial, John Wiley said, Lamar is the person who had the vision for the East Campus Mall. And now when you can stand at the entrance to the, Gordon Commons event, and stand at the entrance to that and look clear to the lake, it's really impressive. And our campus doesn't have much of an entrance or a place that officially says, now you're on the campus.
Right.
And that comes kind of close to it, and it's really nice. And it's even nicer in the summertime when you can go out and walk over to Library Mall for lunch and continue on up to Bascom for a meeting and then come back. And yeah, it just gives much more a sense of cohesion in some ways. So the building's good for that, I think. It wasn't good for collaboration or intra-office events or things like that. But can't have everything.
Well, and you should know, too, that the building at the Fork in the Road has now been raised.
And isn't that beautiful what they've put in there?
It's the water building. I'm not
Is
sure
it?
Exactly who's who gets to be in the water building, but that's...
Huh.
I can see it from my office.
Oh, cool. Well, I was driving out University Avenue one day last week or so, and they've done it really nicely. So as you're driving there, you see down the hallways of that building.
Mm-hmm.
And then offices are on either side. But it just looks like a really cool place.
Yeah, they did an interesting building with the space that they have.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Dania, is there anything else on your mind that you want to get off your mind and on the record? You know, either about activism, social justice, your time as an academic staff here? Big, broad question.
It is. Shared governance is great. I encourage anybody to get involved in it if they can, if their boss is supportive and all, because you meet people you would never meet otherwise. You engage on issues you would never otherwise engage on. It's a great opportunity. I got to go, one of my first years at working on campus, I got to go on the Wisconsin Idea Seminar, which, are you familiar with that? Did you maybe even get to?
I have not.
Ah, too bad. It's a fascinating week. You spend a week going around the state in a bus with other people relatively new to campus and learning about the state. So we went to the penitentiary in Green Bay, and we went to a construction company somewhere in Appleton, and the idea was to just give us a sense of the geography. We went to the Ho-Chunk High School that is in the shape of a turtle.
Huh.
Yeah, it was a neat trip, and that was another thing that I felt just really privileged to get to be able to do. I wish, if I had another life to live on this campus, I would work on diversity issues and social justice issues a lot more. I got to do a lot of that as it was, but there's so much that needs to be done. And we were talking about this morning. We do a fairly good job of getting students here, but once they're here, we don't do a real good job of including them. And there are students who've, you know, been here 5, 6, 8 years and don't feel like they belong after all that time. And that's troubling. We've gone without any kind of a diversity plan since 2008, and that's 5 years ago now. So stepping up and getting that together is a huge job. I used to tell people the most common thing I heard about the university when I first came to work here was, this is a very decentralized place. And I heard it over and over and over again. And one day it hit me, that's a great excuse for not doing things, because it's very decentralized. And I mean, living in the community, I assumed the chancellor would say, all right, here's where we're going, everybody, line up behind me and let's go. And that couldn't be farther from the truth. So the decentralization, I think, is a way for people to shirk responsibility for doing things, but it's also, bless you, it's also a great opportunity, because if you are in a part that, if you're, say, the dean of a college and you have the opportunity to do some things, you're not going to get much flack for that if you're doing bold and creative things. You'll get support for that if you take the time to build up the support within your own work community. So it's a double-edged sword in a way, but it can be used. I've seen people use it as, also the fact that students come and go. I used to see people use that as a, well, okay, we'll tell them that we're gonna do this. And I don't think they necessarily consciously thought that, but they would tell somebody that they were gonna do something knowing that that person was gonna be gone the next year. And they, you know, may or may not actually follow through on that. So it's a fascinating place for somebody who had never worked in a college except for working in my dorm when I was going to school. Mm-hmm. It was a fascinating way to end up a lifetime career in a variety of places. And certainly was liberal enough for me at the end of my working life to live in.
Right.
So that's all I can think of, Troy.
Dania, thank you very much for your time this afternoon.
My pleasure.
So this concludes the interview with Dania Alder. Thank you.
Uh-huh.